I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Over the last year, during my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a visit to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute meditation, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. Over the next few weeks, I'll be talking to people who inspire me, remind me to take better care of myself, and people who I believe you, the listener, will benefit greatly by listening to. I'm so delighted to be joined by Orla Walsh, registered dietitian. Orla, I put it to all my followers on Instagram that I wanted to chat to somebody about diet, and everybody pointed me in your direction. So I'm honoured that you're here today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm gassing anyone knows. I'm just surprised anyone knows who I am.
Oh no, I've seen your Instagram. You have a lot of followers. My podcast is called The Good Glow Podcast. Yeah. Obviously, I've been on this crazy journey over the last year, having been so sick with breast cancer and 5 months of chemotherapy. And as I started to get better, people spoke about me having a glow. So that's why I decided to call the podcast The Good Glow, because I think it's really important to look after your insides and shine from within.
Yeah, I think you probably glowed from inside out. You know, I think that's a hugely scary journey that you went on. And, you know, it makes you think about all aspects of your life, I'm sure.
Let's start with a bit about yourself and how you've come to do what you do.
Oh, yeah. Well, I suppose it's a long story in many ways. You see, it was just, and it was such a natural thing. I guess I've always been healthy and I've always been into health, and I've always been into food, is a simple way to describe it. And I grew up in a very healthy house. You know, my parents grew a lot of veg when I was younger, and, you know, they were always mindful of their weight and very active. Like, my dad's an adventurer. Like, he's canoed around Cape Horn and goes to Greenland on kayaking trips where we can't, you know, we follow him by GPS to know he's alive.
Oh,
you know,
God, that's what an inspiration.
That sort of upbringing. So, you know, we were on the water paddling, like kayaking on Saturdays and hill walking on Sundays. So we were an active family. But in school, I was clearly a scientist, very clearly. Languages, you know, I actually sound like I'm translating when I speak English. And you know, so languages were hard for me, but science was easy. And I loved biology. I loved maths. I loved applied maths. I loved all of that. And so I studied science in Trinity. And we were in around third year science when they came in and they brought in all their healthcare professionals. Because I had specialised in physiology at this stage, which is how the body, all the individual units of the body, how it functions together as one. So they brought in all the healthcare professionals, like a doctor, an occupational therapist, speech and language therapist, physio, and then a dietitian. And it's so embarrassing to say, I had no idea that was even a job, right? And so this dietitian talked, and she was like, oh, you know, it's food, it's maths, it's biology. And I was like, I can make a career out of the things that, like, I enjoy most. So I went on that path. So I had to just do a master's in clinical nutrition to get a background in nutrition to combine with science to try and get into one of the places for dietetics. It's really competitive. Like, at the time, there were 7 places to do it. Some places has a limit of like 4 people and some a max of 12, you know. So I got into King's, which was my first choice, and I was very surprised by that. I studied dietetics and I worked in hospitals in London and then in Cork. And then I had a point where I was like going to continue in the hospital route, which a lot of dietitians are, or try my hand at self-employment. And at the time, a good mate of mine, Aveen Bannon, was having her third baby. And she said, you know, I went into interview and again, I had no breeze who she was because I don't watch the TV and she was on the telly loads. And I think she laughed because I didn't know. And anyway, so she, for some reason, took a risk and asked me to cover maternity leave. And I've just been a self-employed dietitian ever since. So that's over 7 years now.
Wow. So it really was your calling. You knew from early on this is what you wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it was. And because I'm very sporty, you know, I went on to get a master's in sports nutrition. So I worked with some of the Olympians with the Rio 2016. So that was cool as well. But I don't think it was necessarily my true calling in life. So I've kind of taken a step back from sports and I'm kind of going into more the area of fertility. And I actually got more of a kick of, you know, getting a text from a client saying, you know, I'm pregnant after like how many cycles, you know, of IVF and how many years of, you know, trying. And I just, that for me is such an overwhelmingly amazing moment, and I was getting more of a kick out of that than gold medals. So you just have to follow your heart, I suppose.
Yeah, that sounds so rewarding. I can't imagine. So what sort of clients then do you work for? Like, obviously you've
everything. So do you know, like a GP, you go to your GP, your doctor, so they're a general practitioner and anything can go through their door. And it's the same with mine. I'm a general practitioner, but just in nutrition. And it's people wanting to lose weight, it's diabetes, it's heart disease, it's eating disorders, it's still sports, because, you know, I can't get, like, my, I still like it. Yeah. And I have the qualifications and everything. So there's a mixture, it's a very broad, and gut health is a huge one, I think, as well. I think everyone's gut is acting up.
Yeah, I think so. And just kind of the amount of like fast food and stuff like that, I'm sure all contributes to that.
Well, that and a fast life, mm-hmm. you know, so it's about time, and it's time management. But thankfully, they are, sorry, I hate saying brands, but you know, the iPhone has this new thing where it shows people how long they're spending on different apps.
Yes.
And I make people with iPhones open them up in clinic. And I was like, okay, so you don't have time to cook your own meals or exercise. Show me how much time you spend every day on Instagram. And like, they're, you know, it could be 5 hours, up to 5 hours if they're younger. It's really amazing.
That's an eye opener, isn't it?
It is, because I'm like, see, you do have time. We just have to readjust where you put your time.
Let's talk about cancer and food. My doctor told me as I was recovering from cancer that there was no diet for what I was going through, and that basically I just need to aim for my 5 a day. When I was diagnosed with cancer, I had obviously, you know, read things online before, and I think there's a lot of guilt associated with people that get diagnosed with cancer, because you may have read sugar causes cancer, everything causes cancer. So when I got sick, I thought it was my fault, and I thought it was something that I may have eaten throughout the years. You know, was it microwave popcorn? Was it this? Was it that? And I just think it's so blurred and it's so unclear exactly what causes cancer. Of course, we don't know. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think people are very vulnerable at that time, and they're vulnerable when they get diagnosed. They're vulnerable during treatment because it's very tiring. I think one of the symptoms that most people have is it's tiring. And then some people, depending on the treatment, are also quite sick and vomiting and losing their hair, and other people, you know, it just depends on the treatment. So I think people are vulnerable upon diagnosis, upon treatment, and afterwards. And the thing is that the great news is that diet and lifestyle can help reduce the risk of getting cancer, but also reduce the risk of relapsing or getting cancer again. But it's not as black and white as people make out. So, you know, for the most part, it's not someone's fault. It's just really, really poor luck. It's genetically poor luck, because the thing is, the body's creating cancer all the time, but then there's this thing called cell suicide, apoptosis, and then, you know, the cells go, no, we're replicating like we shouldn't, and they just die off. But you see, that happens all the time, and as you get older, the chances of the body not getting there soon enough to stop that happening obviously, you know, increases as time goes on. And it is just bad luck. But I think that what the research needs to be done is to use it in a positive way. Go, okay, well, I had really bad luck. It wasn't my fault. But what can I do to reduce the risk of it happening again? And there's certain things that are really, really clear. And exercise is probably one of the biggest ones, especially for something like breast cancer. And then it's looking at, especially later in life, it's keeping your body fat levels at a healthy level. So not too low, not too high, but specifically not too high. So coming towards menopause and afterwards is trying to keep your weight stable as much as possible. So those two are really important. In terms of overall nutrition. There's loads of new and exciting things coming out all the time. And the problem is the new and exciting things. I would love to spend my life talking about them. But what I find is I spend my life talking about the myths associated. You know, there was a lot of... There's a lot of media talk about sugar and low carb, high fat diets and cancer last year. And unfortunately, there just isn't evidence there. There's evidence in terms of a ketogenic diet for other things like epilepsy, but there's not evidence there for cancer. There's not even one human study that you can talk about. So I think that's really unfair for someone who's vulnerable to read these things and think, well, firstly, it's my fault because I was eating carbohydrate, or secondly, to think that this is true when it's not.
Do you think that cancer survivors should avoid inflammatory foods? I've seen so much about this recently, and yeah. I think Tom Brady and Giselle spoke about their diet and how they stay away from inflammatory foods, and it kind of...
I read her diet. I was thinking, jakers, do you know, she's supposed to be a mum of how many? How much staff does she have?
They clearly just have a chef in their kitchen who's able to make them vegetable sushi all day long.
All I kept thinking when I was reading it is that's not nutritionally complete, not even by a long shot.
Because I did hear something on News Talk before, and they were talking about being a vegan, yeah. saying that the average person cannot, you know, get all the nutrients they need from being a vegan. Like, obviously a super celebrity with a chef and, yeah. you know, access to all these amazing ingredients, but the kind of regular Joe soap is not going to get what they need.
Exactly. So it's not a nutritionally complete diet. So the layperson will have to supplement the nutrients that are just simply missing from a vegan diet. So, for example, there's no omega-3, EPA and DHA, that sort of omega-3 in a vegan diet. It comes from oily fish. So if you're not eating oily fish, you don't get it. However, a celebrity might be able to get the algae that has omega-3 and consume that twice a week. And then, you know, vitamin D, it's pretty much just eggs and oily fish again. So if a vegan's not eating those, then where do they get it? A celebrity might be able to get mushrooms that have been in the sun long enough, and specific type of mushrooms to get vitamin D, but like the layman can't. So there's a lot of missing nutrients, and that's an unfortunate thing. And I think people are going down the route of a vegan diet without knowing that there's a lot of nutritional gaps that you really need to make sure that are filled, because if you don't fill them, you're going to have complications of that, both in the short and the long term. But I suppose it's a challenging diet to follow in the long term anyway. So I'm not sure if the majority of people could follow it, because food, as you say, it's more than just fuel. It's taste. You know, could they avoid burgers for the rest of their life? You know, could they avoid an omelette? Like, you know, will they eventually get fed up and go to brunch places and not being able to eat eggs? You know, yeah. So there is that. And food is social, and food has religious beliefs for a lot of people. You know, food yeah. is just much, much, much more than fuel.
When I was getting better and, you know, I was thinking about my diet, what my doctor said to me, there is no diet for this, really kind of hit home with me. And instead of looking around for a diet, what I decided to do was just take on a challenge of eating 5 to 7 a day.
Brilliant.
So what I do now is I try to get as much fruit and veg into meals as possible. And that, to be honest, feels like a full-time job to me at the moment. You know, hitting a target of 7 a day is quite difficult.
Yeah, it does become habit though. I will encourage you to keep going with it, because the longer you do it, it does become easy. Like, it gets to the stage where you look down at a meal, and if there's not colour in it, you're disappointed.
Yeah.
So colourful meals smile back at you. You know, that's the way to look at it. And it's when we have colourful meals, like, it triggers more than taste buds. You know, it makes us smile. Like, there's nothing more lovely than a colourful diet. And when we're eating beige food, you know, we'll feel beige. So there's certain fruits and vegetables as well, in terms of cancer protection, that I think people need to maybe add a little bit more into their diet. And it would be the orange and yellow ones. So there's a good amount of research there behind the orange and yellow fruit and veg. And most people love them anyway. So that's not hardship for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it's about, like, I suppose, little changes. So now if I'm having a chickpea curry, I'll put it on a bed of sweet potato as opposed to a bed of rice.
Yeah.
And I find it just as filling, even a little bit more tasty.
It might even be more filling because sweet potato would have more fiber in it. So not only would it be more filling, but it would keep you fuller for longer. So, but sweet potato is delicious. It's naturally sweet, you know, and I think that's something that you should continue to enjoy and to continue enjoy a variety in your diet. But there's some evidence that suggests that a diet that has dairy in it and a diet that has lots of calcium rich foods in it will also reduce your risk of breast cancer reoccurrence and breast cancer in general. So when people cut foods out, I worry that they're cutting out important foods that we know we have strong enough evidence to say, listen, I think you should probably do this. So, you know, dairy as milk, yogurt and cheese as we know it. But there's loads of other calcium rich foods like soy products and figs and green vegetables and tofu and the like. So there's lots of foods out there to be enjoyed.
You're just talking there about cow's milk and a lot of people are ditching cow's milk and moving to nut milk. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's just a fad. It's just a phase. It's a phase like every other, like the low-fat movement or the low-carb movement. Remember that? We've all gone back to carbs quite happily with a big smile on our face. Then there was high protein and people were only eating like it was rashers everywhere, you know, chorizo everywhere. And then people moved to plant proteins, which is great. You know, plant proteins are great for you. But this whole ditching dairy thing, it's a fad. Like everyone, it's going to run its course. You see, the problem is it's somewhat, and I'm feeding into it because, for example, I call the likes of nut milks like almond milk or something milk alternatives, but they're not even. Don't get me wrong, we use them as alternatives in our diet, but they don't even nearly contain the same nutrients. And so milk would naturally contain calcium, it would naturally contain vitamin B2, vitamin B12, and all these other hosts of nutrients. While these, we'll call them nut cordials, they contain the nuts and they contain water, and then they contain the vitamins and minerals that are added to them. So they're not an exact exchange. In fact, you know, what they're missing, a big ingredient that they're missing is protein. And protein, when it comes to protein, we need it at every single meal. We don't need loads of protein, but we need adequate amount. And if you were to swap out dairy and put in, just say you're making a porridge on milk and then you changed it for almond milk, now there's not a protein source in that meal. So you're not going to hit your protein requirements at that mealtime. And that will leave you less satisfied at the meal because protein is filling. And protein takes ages to leave your stomach, so you'll be fuller sooner afterwards. So they're not milk alternatives because they're not a fair exchange. They're not a complete exchange. So this is the problem. The other problem with them is that some are unsweetened, but some have oodles of added sugar. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you look at the most common almond milk, for example, that's the regular one. They've added around 8 teaspoons of sugar to it. And think how easy it is to drink down sugar. Like if I had a bowl of sugar, I don't, but if I had a bowl of sugar right in front of you, it made you eat 8 teaspoons of a spoon. You'd be like, no,
retching for days.
You couldn't, your teeth.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's really easy to drink down the sugar. And then when they flavor it, there's even more sugar added. So, yeah, they're not fair exchanges. And I need to stop calling it milk alternatives because it's not an alternative to milk. Are they harmful? You can get the unsweetened ones and they taste nice and they're part of a healthy diet, but they're not an exchange for actual milk. And I think people will learn their lessons perhaps the hard way. So, for example, I've got clients who would have cut out dairy and they're very young and they've been diagnosed with osteoporosis. It's not even osteopenia, which is on the way to getting osteoporosis, full-blown osteoporosis where their bones look like an Aero bar rather than a Cadbury's milk bar. So they're kind of hollow. And that's a serious problem, especially to develop at such a young age. So people are acknowledging the consequence of it. But I think people focus in too much on calcium. So for example, a lot of the milk alternatives, the majority don't contain iodine. So iodine is a mineral that we get from milk, we get it from fish, and we get it from seaweed. But Irish people don't eat much seaweed. Mm-hmm. We don't, even though we have loads of seaweed in Ireland, we don't eat much fish at all. Again, if that drives me mad. So we rely heavily on getting our iodine from milk. So if you cut out iodine, so just say I'm pregnant now, I'm 5 months, and if I wasn't getting enough iodine in my diet while pregnant, the neurodevelopment, the brain development of my baby would be compromised. The IQ of my baby once it's born will be compromised. The reading skills won't be as good as a baby that was getting adequate iodine. So it's unsafe to just be pulling foods out willy-nilly. You need to, like, if you have, just say, cow's milk protein allergy, which is quite rare in adulthood, or if you just say you really feel strongly about becoming a vegan for moral and ethical and all these reasons, then go to a dietitian mm-hmm. and go, listen, I appreciate there's going to be loads of nutrient gaps. Help me fill them. Because, you know, you have a responsibility to yourself, and if you're female and if you're going to be reproducing, you have responsibility to the next generation.
But you almost, like, you can't blame people. I mean, it's wall to wall scaremongering. Like, every time I go online, it's avoid this, I'm giving up this, I'm going to start this diet, and it's very everywhere. Confusing, crazy world.
Of course, yeah, like it is. And I don't know how they're going to combat that other than to encourage people to just follow registered dietitian are qualified people, because there's a lot of scaremongering out there.
Are we becoming too fixated between good and bad food?
Oh, absolutely. And we wrongly blame something as bad. So, for example, remember potatoes? Everyone hated potatoes for a while.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that's over as well. But the thing is, the potato is one of the few foods we eat in the right portion. Like, our standard portion of pasta or rice is at least four times the portion of our standard portion of potato.
Yes.
So it means actually per natural serving calorie, our potatoes are one of the lowest calorie and lowest carbohydrates out there. You know, it's the one thing we actually eat in the right portion. So if we're having potato, it's a quarter of our plate. If we're having pasta or rice or noodles, it's the whole plate.
You'd almost feel guiltier for eating a potato than a plate of pasta.
And it could be less than 100 calories your natural portion of potato. It's phenomenal. And potatoes are, again, so good for you. Potassium, vitamin C. There's loads of things in them, as well as, like, in the skins, vitamin K. You know, so they're really good for us. So that's the problem, wrongly saying something's bad or good. The other thing about saying something's bad or good is, you feel bad for eating the bad stuff, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in truth, it's only kind of healthy or less healthy, because when it comes to nutrition, it's all about context. So, for example, jellies might not be considered the healthiest food. And I agree, they're not the healthiest food. But if my sister is having a hypo because she's type 1 diabetic, I will be getting her jellies, because in that scenario, it's the healthiest thing for her. So it is, it's all about context. Like, grapefruit, really healthy. It's actually there was one study that suggested it lowered your cholesterol, and grapefruit's great for you. But if you're on statins, perhaps you shouldn't be having grapefruit. So it is, it's all about context, and there's no such thing as a good or bad food. And I think I think Irish people on whole would do much better if they actually just set about improving their relationship with food. And if you look at food as something to enjoy it, and something to make you healthy, and something to keep you lean, and something, you know, all these mm-hmm. wonderful things about food, something that tastes damn good, you know, and stop looking at it in a black and white or a good versus bad way, because that encourages a bad relationship with food.
I think before I got sick, I would have seen, now I was fairly healthy before yeah. I got sick, but if I had have eaten a really healthy meal, I would say, that's great now. I'm going to, you know, I won't have much calories. I'll stay skinny, and hopefully, you know, my skin will get a boost.
Yeah.
And then I think when I got so sick and I realized that I needed nutrients for my body to recover week after week to get in order to get my chemotherapy, it completely changed my relationship with food.
Yeah.
And now I look at a salad and I see energy in it. I see, you know, nutrients. I see things that I just kind of took for granted before. I didn't think about before. Yeah. And the fact that I've eaten healthily for 1 year now, I've seen the benefits.
Yeah.
So I've seen the difference in my skin. I didn't have patience before to drink 2 liters of water every day for a year to see what would happen, because I wanted instant results.
Yeah.
And when I didn't see them, I'd forget about it and I'd just kind of go back to normal. So hydration and water is so important, isn't it?
It is. I think what you're describing is when you eat really well and you look after yourself holistically, you actually feel as good as you're designed to feel. And I think people, you know, when you hear of young people especially feeling tired or, you know, dragging themselves around the place, and I'm like, you're not actually designed to feel that way. We're not actually designed to hurt when we walk or struggle, you know, for energy. You know, when you eat well, you feel how good your body's supposed to feel. And it's an enlightening experience, I have to say. But you're right, hydration is incredibly important. Even 2% dehydration will reduce your mental acuity. So your speed of thought, accuracy of thought, your ability to think. And it really is profound. So when people actually hydrate themselves enough, it transforms them. And it's the number one energizer for sure. Like when people are dehydrated, their energy goes down.
Are the majority of us dehydrated?
I think it's funny because I'm seeing a lot of people that are like, I drink 6 liters a day, and I'm like, you're drowning yourself. You know,
how is that possible?
Idea.
That's a full-time job.
You must spend a lot of toilet paper. You know, so it's a kind of a happy medium. Generally, you get your weight in kilos and times by 35, and that's how much fluid you need every day. As an average. So for most women, it's around 2 liters. But then if you've just, say, worn a dress that's too warm that day for the weather, you'll sweat a bit more and you'll need more fluid. Or if you go to the gym or exercise, you'd need more fluid. Or if you're at high altitude, you'll need more fluid. So I think the best way to look at it is your urine. So you're aiming for pale urine, you're aiming to pee every few hours, and you're aiming for a really good flow. So if you were to count Mississippi, like 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, 4 Mississippi, you need at least 4 Mississippis. So you want that pee to be a good volume.
And I think I peed so much when I was pregnant, and I drank so much water when I was pregnant that it almost kind of set me up for like my cancer journey. And
especially the third trimester, it makes people feel like they've undiagnosed diabetes. They're just like practically drinking out of vases,
it's,
you know?
It's constant. Have you heard much about the term orthorexia?
Orthorexia.
Yeah. I've heard it popping up recently.
Yeah. So with eating disorders, there's anorexia nervosa. People have heard of that. They've probably heard of bulimia as well. Orthorexia is kind of... It's nearly come about, well, it's been around for a long, long time, of course, but it's become more popular since this good versus bad food. This whole clean eating trend. I loved clean eating at the start because I thought it was very simple. You eat foods of one ingredient, you eat a whole food diet most of the time, and you carried on. You know, you exercise as well. But now it's gone so far that, you know, sure, if you were to go by Instagram, normal potatoes are bad, sweet potatoes are good, normal chocolate is bad, dark chocolate is good. You know, it's very black and white, and sure, that's not what nutrition is about, and that's not what any science is about. And there's no such thing as fact. You know, even as a scientist, you're nearly trained to say our best current evidence suggests that, you know. So with orthorexia, it's people taking these things too far. So in the clinic, we would see people with orthorexia, myself and Aveen, and you know, it's like you get young girls or young boys, we have more and more boys, and they're coming in younger and younger, like not even teenagers in primary school, and the fear of sugar. The fear of sugar is huge, and that's what we're seeing at the moment. And we're seeing a lot of orthorexics and people clean eating and vegans, and to the point that they're doing it for all the wrong reasons. You know, they're doing it because they see food as dirty if it's not clean. And they proper, like, they get full on anxiety. Like, if I ask, and it's not about calories, while other forms of eating disorder might be about, oh, that's 100 calories and I'm not eating that. But like, if you offered someone with clean eating, for example, a tablespoon of almond butter, they'd much rather that than eat one jelly or even to lick a jelly, you know. Okay. So it's very complicated. And when we see them in the clinic, you know, they're always attending a chartered psychologist as well, and you know, going to their GP for medical support. But it's very scary. And it can go undiagnosed because, like, for example, a mum might think, oh, the daughter is just very healthy, very into healthy eating, very disciplined, but they don't realise actually it's a condition, and the consequences of it might not be under eating or might not be throwing up, but the consequences of it in terms of quality of life are huge.
Wow. We hear a lot, I suppose, coming into winter, and you know, you got to take your vitamins and you got to take your Baracas and your vitamin D. And is there anything that
the
you
most
think people should know?
Urine you'll have. Yeah, you see, the thing is that a lot of vitamins and minerals, like if especially the B and C vitamins, like if you take excess of them, they are just going to come out in your pee. But that said, listen, I'm not anti-supplements in any shape or form. Actually, supplements are needed firstly to fill nutritional gaps. And sometimes they're needed just because we can't get enough through food. So we need to be taking 400 micrograms of folic acid, mm-hmm. if whether or not you intend to get pregnant, because I think 1 in 2 pregnancies aren't planned. What happened? And so, you know, most women of childbearing age, if not all of them, should be taking a folic acid supplement. And then vitamin D, because there's only eggs and oily fish and we can't rely on our sunshine. We had a great summer this year now, but we can't rely on our sunshine, especially during winter months, because, you know, of our latitude and lots of things, and, you know, wrapping up, and then the sun doesn't exist as much as we'd like. So vitamin D might be needed. And then it comes into what I love, the area of kind of medicinal supplementation. So it's kind of going, okay, you suffer from migraines, let's try vitamin B2, or you suffer from migraines, let's try magnesium. And I give people a precise dose that they have to follow for a little while and see if it helps, or PMS, vitamin B6, or high triglycerides, omega-3. So there are times that you would use supplements as a medicinal, for medicinal reasons. But I think a lot of people take excess, mm-hmm. take super high doses or doses that are piddly. Like, do you know, like people might take zinc because they have a cold, but take hardly any zinc. And you're like, actually, you need over a 75, you know, for that, you know. So I think it's too extreme. So they don't take enough, or they take too much, or else they take the wrong type of that supplement, and therefore it has no effect. One of the most obvious ones has to be probiotics. Mm. The majority of probiotics on the market haven't been tested to make it through your stomach acid. So they go into your mouth, into your stomach, and might never go into your intestines.
Wow.
And the whole reason you're taking them is for the probiotics to get into your intestines to work their magic. But if you don't have evidence that that supplement actually makes it to your colon, like, it is the biggest waste of money. And some of them are like a year or a day, if not more. So I think probiotics is probably the one that it would stand out to me that people are wasting their money. The vitamin B and vitamin C drinks as well, I think people are wasting their money. The gas thing is, I was out for brunch one Sunday, and I saw a girl, and she was clearly hungover. But I saw her take a couple of vitamin C tablets and put them in water. And I'm thinking, I'm there kind of going, oh, Jakers, don't be doing that. Because, you know, for one, she'll probably get the runs. Okay. So she was taking such a high dose, I was like, you're going to get the runs. And then secondly, I was like, oh, because if she had had sex the night before, her contraception might not be working if she gets the runs and takes too much vitamin C.
Yeah.
So I'm like, do I tell her? You know, like, I have these moments.
Do I continue eating my French toast or go over
or
to table five
and say it's a bad idea to be taking that much vitamin C, because, you know, you're going to make your tummy sick and you might not be absorbing your contraception.
And turmeric and sage and green tea tablets, yeah, and things like that, is there harm in taking those?
There can be. So one made the news recently when someone took green tea extract and took a super high dose and ended up with liver failure. That's really scary. But the thing is that when they're used properly, it actually could be a very exciting Exciting bit of nutrition. So for example, like, there's lots of evidence behind cinnamon. And cinnamon's just something we have at home, and, you know, put a teaspoon of it a day in your porridge, and there's evidence for loads of stuff, you know, blood sugar control, cholesterol lowering and stuff. Now, you know, but the problem is with the turmeric or one of those is that the studies at the moment are extracts of it. And if you were to actually use that in your daily life, you would actually need 8 teaspoons of it. And when on earth are you going to put 8 teaspoons of it?
That would be rough on the stomach.
It would. And the meal would taste horrible. So, you know, the evidence is really exciting. So I think in terms of a lot of the herbs and spices, we might need to either combine a load of them to get the result and without making our food taste manky, or look at extracts. But for instance, you know, there's blue zones in the world where people live over 100, you know, quite often. And one of the places, I think, is in Italy. They use lots of rosemary. And rosemary is very high in antioxidants. So, again, you know, there's research going on at the moment, like, is, well, you know, how powerful is rosemary? We know it's high in antioxidants, but what does it do for us? Is it going to reduce the process of aging? So I think all these things are really exciting. But I would be careful for, I would really tell people to be careful with the supplements, because a lot of those supplements aren't regulated. Most of them aren't. Mm. And most of them don't contain what they're supposed to.
When I was going through chemotherapy at the start of my chemo journey, what I was trying to get my iron back up every week so I could get the chemo again. So I was throwing everything and anything into my NutriBullet. And I went into my nurse one week and I said, yeah, you know, I'm drinking 2 smoothies a day. And she said, why are you putting all your spinach in the NutriBullet? Just eat it. And I kind of was like, oh yeah, why don't I just eat it in a salad, you know? Because it's kind of easier to just knock it back. But in fact, I would much rather eat spinach in its natural form. And is there benefits to eating it in its natural form, or are you breaking it down by putting it in a NutriBullet?
Well, it's just doing the chewing for you, so you'll digest it much quicker and you'll be hungrier sooner, which is probably, if you're very nauseated and you just want cold nutrition and to get nutrition into your body, like, that's probably the easiest way for you. But when you're not nauseated and you're trying to maintain your weight, because the thing about breast cancer is some people gain weight when they go to the treatment, so I would encourage them to eat their food rather than drink it. The thing about the iron supplement's really interesting, because it's one of the most common deficiencies in the world, and people, you know, when you speak to the majority of women, they've been supplementing at one time or another. But the interesting thing about iron is that it's toxic to the body if you take it in excess. So what happens if you take an iron supplement one day? The body secretes this thing called hepcidin and stops you absorbing any more iron until it's recalibrated and said, no, we've now put that, you know, into your iron levels or whatever. So if you were to take it every single day, you get gut upset, because the second day you take it, this hepcidin thing has been secreted, absorption's been blocked, and ends up just lying there in your gut, causing irritation. So it's funny how people perceive iron supplements. They're like, oh, I get anemic, but I can't take iron supplements because they wreck my tummy. And I'm like, take them every other day or every third day, and you'll absorb just as much and you won't have the gut issues. So sometimes when it comes to supplements, it's like how you take them is really, really important.
And that's why it's just so important to get advice from an expert when you're starting that.
And I'm sure during chemo they advise you be careful with high dose of vitamins and minerals, because you might actually, the vitamins and minerals might get in the way of the chemo working.
Yeah, and that's why they basically tell me not to take anything, you know, just to have a balanced diet, come in, get your chemo. We'll hope that, to God, that your bloods are okay. And if not, you take a week off and you just have a rest.
That's the thing. So a high dose of vitamins is a really bad idea if you're going through chemotherapy. But It's also with chemotherapy, the most important thing is keeping your energy and your strength up so that you can get the amount of chemo that you need in the time frame that you need it. And one of the most important things when going through chemo is actually trying not to lose weight, because when you lose 10% of your weight, or 5 to 10%, which is a significant amount, you will receive less chemo and you'll receive it over a longer period, and therefore it'll be less effective. So a lot of nutrition advice during chemotherapy is don't take vitamins, and, you know, just watch your weight and try and keep your weight stable.
I think the unfortunate thing in Ireland is, you know, the hospitals are so stretched, or when you go to see your doctor, like, you have a list of 100 things that you're going to ask, and you know, diet is down the bottom of the list. And quite often the doctor doesn't really have time to get into that, you know, because you've got a certain amount of time and they're talking about much bigger things. And so patients are relying on kind of a 5-minute chat with a nurse. Like, do you wish that patients had access to people that could help them with nutrition?
Oh, I think so. And I think it's really, really important. There's some, it depends where the cancer is. So if you have cancer of head and neck, you probably always see a dietitian, you know, and then there's certain conditions that you might never see, like breast cancer, like they might never even set eyes on a dietitian the whole time. And I think it's really, really important. And especially if, like, because we have this evidence, from over 200,000 people, and of, you know, this will reduce your risk, this will increase your risk, you know, and then once you're recovered, you know, and it's busting myths as well. Like, so after cancer treatment, soya foods are actually a good thing because they reduce the risk of it happening again. But there's lots of myths out there would make people believe.
I thought the opposite.
Yeah.
What do you wish people knew more of? Like, you know, you said the potato thing, like, you know, that's kind of an eye opener for a lot of people who are just like, oh God, I just kind of presumed we had to avoid potatoes.
Yeah.
Like, is there something like, you know, like around olive oils and things like that? And people are scared to cook with oils now. And
yeah. And they think coconut oils and bee's knees and cat's pajamas when it's not actually. The evidence suggests that coconut oil is, let's put it in the less healthy food bracket. And the likes of olive oil is very much in the healthy bracket. Yeah, I think there's just so many myths. I think that's why, you know, I have a few followers. I probably don't have as much as you or anyone else that you have on your podcast in terms of following on Instagram. But like, that's why I spend most of my time there. I'm like debunking these myths because I think there's a lot of confusion out there. Like tea and coffee, they're not bad for us. They actually hydrate us. They don't dehydrate.
So like coffee doesn't dehydrate us.
It doesn't. So there's loads of these myths that I would just love to be
I
like.
I blame the Daily Mail.
I know. I blame you for reading it.
I know. Do you know what?
Says me with the app.
I'm about to delete that app. There's a lot of things that I'm getting rid of out of my life because I work so hard every day on trying to survive and trying to keep a positive attitude. So a while ago, I deleted my Facebook app because I was working so hard on my mental health all day, and then I was getting into bed and being served all of this cancer stuff. And I was always only Googled, you know, positive cancer things like cancer survivors and, you know, Juliana Rancic and people that I'd heard, Christina Applegate and people giving talks about cancer, nothing bad. But then I was getting into bed at night and getting all the bad stuff. And I was like, I need to take charge here. So Daily Mail might be the next one to go, even it is a guilty pleasure.
It is. But all this criticizing of women's body, and it's by women. You're like, stop it. Do you know, like pointing out someone's cellulite on the beach, like everyone's ass is a bit of cellulite. Cop on now. Like,
it's when you're on your knees and you're sick. And I just had a baby when I got sick, and I Pia was 7 months old, and I still had like baby fat, you know. And when I got sick, I looked in the mirror and I realized I absolutely loved my body.
Yeah.
Like, well, I loved every inch of it. And I hated it the week before when, you know.
Created life. What could be more amazing than that?
And every lump and bump. And I just appreciated it so much. And now, you know, I've had a lumpectomy and, you know, my boobs don't exactly match. But I don't care. What are your healthy habits?
You see, that's the thing. Like, I'd say I have loads of them embedded and I just don't know it. You know, so for one, I always start in the morning. I always have a pint of water. So we usually lose around a pint of water overnight. And I know I sound very unglamorous, but I think I'm sweatier than most. So I'm like, so I drink the pint of water first thing in the morning. I always have a big breakfast. My breakfast is by far my biggest meal of the day. Like other people would be like, you're eating all that for breakfast. I'm like, yes, I am. So my breakfast is my biggest, my dinner is the smallest. So I think that's a healthy habit to get into. For most people, they just need to make it 3 meals of equal size and then work towards that. I walk everywhere, absolutely everywhere. Like, I know I don't like driving that much, but Like I did recently this year buy a posh new car, so you know, try to inhale. But I would much rather walk, so I walk absolutely everywhere. And so I think I've loads of healthy habits embedded in. I'm very meticulous with sleep, so I have a bedtime routine. I go to bed at the same time every night and wake up the same time in the morning. Sleep is my number one priority. I don't take nutrition too seriously, and I think that's why people probably like me as a dietitian, because they're like, do you know, like I'm not dead skinny, and like I'm slim. Well, I don't feel slim right now. In 5 months, I'm like,
you look amazing. You're glowing.
I don't know.
Amazing.
That's probably sweat. But you know, I don't take it too seriously. Mm-hmm. Like even I was 2 weeks ago, and people don't recognize me like ever, right? It's probably had a handful of times in my life, and I was in, and I was out with my husband. We were getting, we shared a pizza and we shared truffle parmesan chips, right? And we were there, and the person put down the food, and she goes, "Oh, I follow you on Instagram," and I was like, "Of course!" Like I was like, "Oh, Grant," you know. She goes, "Oh, I knew you were real," and like as that's in, like,
it's the biggest normal compliment you could ever get.
Yeah, so you know, I'm a normal person, so I don't take nutrition too seriously. Like you know, I weigh myself every so often to check in, but not regularly, to be honest, like maybe 3 or 4 times a year. But, you know, like, so I don't take it too seriously. I sleep well, I exercise, and I eat. I expect every meal to be colourful.
It's all about balance. Where can people find you?
Well, on Instagram, Orla Walsh Nutrition. I have a website, Orla Walsh Nutrition too, and on Facebook, Orla Walsh Nutrition. And then on Twitter, it's Orla C. Walsh.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new episodes. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. You can check out thegoodglow.ie for more on my story and follow me on Instagram @GeorgieJCrawford.